Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and we are going to have two guests today. We have Barbara Abercrombie with us right now, and her book is titled A Year of Writing Dangerously. If you're a creative person, if you are someone that has yearned to be published, if there's just this love of taking a word and making it into something that is a living, breathing essence on a piece of paper or in something that you express through an email, through whatever form you choose, this is a lady I think you're going to enjoy coming to know. Barbara has published more than one book of her own, but we're going to go into a little bit deeper with how to write dangerously. Hi, Barbara. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Donna. Thanks for having me.
Creativity. My goodness, I was reviewing material for other potential guests, and I sit and I look at all of these books, which I can have anywhere from 75 to 100 of them on my review table at any time, sometimes more, and I look at this and I go, wow, all of this creativity, and it's being expressed with the written word. There might be some pictures, there's nice covers on the books, but to read, to enter into the world of thought of any individual, to me is an awesome experience. And you, as a writer, you yourself have found this to be a passion of your own, and you've done so many books. Barbara, did a teacher inspire you when you were young, or did you sit and chew on a pencil when you were in elementary school wondering, what can I put down on this piece of paper? What is it that planted the seed of writing creatively in you?
I started writing stories when I was 6 years old, and I honestly don't know why, but I remember the first story I wrote, and I found it years and years later. My father had kept it his whole life, and when he died, he still had it in his files. But I just love telling stories, and I used to escape into reading books, and I thought everybody wrote stories. I didn't realize in the beginning that, you know, it really was difficult to do it as a profession, but I love stories. I'm in love with stories, and I feel so lucky because I have felt this way my whole life. And it is wonderful when you have a passion, I have to say.
Well, I myself have always been an avid reader, which is fortunate because that's what I do with this show.
Right.
That's been my entire life, and nobody else in my family has it. My husband said, maybe you ought to study your family tree. Maybe somewhere 500 generations back, somebody did the same thing. I don't know.
Right.
But I really love the written word, and I think that there is so much that can be conveyed through the use of words. Now, you yourself are a teacher, and you've written, what, 14, 15, 16 books?
14, I'm writing my 15th book will be published next spring.
Wow. Now, that is such a wonderful accomplishment, I think, because every one of your books, you've been on my show before, every one of your books, there is a message for it. But you teach at UCLA, the writer's program there, that must be quite fascinating to you as a teacher to see how students look at the world and express their feelings, their ideas, their concepts through the written word. As a teacher, what is the greatest challenge that you have with your students?
I think the greatest challenge, and I teach an extension, so I have ages, all age students, which I just love, from age 18 to 80. And that the greatest challenge is to let them just be loose and free, to get them to be free. And to do that, I do a lot of 5-minute writing exercises where they're not allowed to stop writing for 5 minutes. And I have different exercises and prompts that I give them. And I think the challenge for me, or what my goal is with them, is that they will be free to tell their stories. And I believe passionately that everybody has a story to write, one way or another, whether it's, you know, as fiction or to something to be published, or, you know, simply on a blog or in a journal or as a self-published autobiography for their family. So I encourage all kinds of ways to put your story on the paper.
I think that is marvelous, because there are, I know just from interviewing so many people, I've interviewed close to 3,000 people in my 11 years of broadcasting, and I look at how every single person had a different story, had a different way of expressing themselves, and I think sharing the stories are so important. Fiction, nonfiction, it doesn't make any difference. There are those nuggets of gold that many times people don't realize that they're sharing with others that will make a very significant impact on them.
Yeah.
And
oh, I
really think that that is a wonderful gift when you are able to put that into writing. And you never know. You just never know who's going to pick it up and read it.
Right, exactly. And I think by sharing our stories, by telling our stories, we are giving other people a gift, because they realize, I think it was EC, I forget who it was, who said, the reason we read is to realize we're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people who go through difficult times, and we all go through difficult times, I mean, we all have had really bad patches in our lives. And
absolutely,
to share that, it's very helpful to other people.
Yes.
How we get
and
through that.
Yes, and I think that has been a healing process, too, for many writers.
Yes.
When they are able to share the drama, the tragedy, whatever may have gone in their life. And like you said, someone picking up and reading it goes, oh, my word, you mean this person went through this? I am not alone. Just supporting what you have just said.
Yeah.
I think that is, it's private. It's personal.
Exactly.
You are able to integrate this, and you can heal. Just like the person that wrote the story frequently heals by the writing, it touches others in a way that allows them to heal as well. So I think that is wonderful. Now, there is a statement in your book, the very first day. Now, this is 365 days of inspiration and encouragement. For those of you that love to write, that's wonderful. For those of you that love to read, this is terrific. It really is a good book.
Thank you.
You have the very, very first day, Switchbacks Up the Mountain. The sentence that I really grabbed onto is, writing has always felt just like that road up the mountain, scary, full of dangerous switchbacks. Now, what a phenomenal verbal description, because that's life. We get those switchbacks all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do. and I think writing is, sometimes we get so excited on inspiration. I always tell my students, for heaven's sakes, you can't write and rely on inspiration. Inspiration comes when you're writing, usually. Sometimes it's very scary to put the truth down or what you've been through. You're afraid that somebody's going to read it and say, you know, that didn't really happen, or your family's going to read it and get mad. And so another challenge to a teacher is, write it, and you can always tear it up. You know, you can decide who's going to read it. Keep it very private. And at some point, after it's crafted, you know, you spill out stuff on paper, but then if you do want to publish it or have other people read it, then you craft it, and you do have more, you have control over your stories. And it's interesting you're talking about healing, Donna, because I'm teaching a course at UCLA this fall called Writing the Healing Story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how many people sign up for that course because of the word healing in it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There is a release with writing, and I like what you said about if you don't, if you want, you can burn it. That is a
mm-hmm.
technique that has been used for helping people to heal in an incredible way, because there is something about getting that part of yourself out, whether it has been an embarrassment, whether it has been something that has been very dark in your life. Maybe you lived an experience that you just think if people heard about it, they would label you, which I think is a very, very hurtful type of experience if ever you've gone through something like that. So when you can write about it, and then you can have a burning bowl ceremony. And just have to go up and say, that's my task. It's not me anymore. So your terms, writing is like courting the muse, which is very, very true. You call it a calling. And what we said, if you want, you just tear things up. But again, going back to daring to tell, and each one of these days, 365 days, there are these comments by different writers that you've implemented. And this one, like on day six, daring to tell, I thought was extremely powerful. And you used a quote by Wallace Shawn and Andre Gregory.
Right.
And it's from their publication, My Dinner with Andre. And I'll read it. You know, we do live in ludicrous ignorance of each other. I mean, we usually don't know the things we'd like to know, even about our supposedly closest friends. I mean, suppose you're going through some kind of hell in your life. Well, you'd love to know if your friends have experienced similar things, but we really don't dare to ask one another.
Right.
We go around wearing masks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In wearing... Go ahead.
Well, and I think that's what happens in a writing class if people feel safe, or a writing group. It's amazing to me how quickly they drop their masks, because we all have masks, especially I live in Los Angeles, and everyone has huge masks that they wear. But in a writing class, once they start writing from their heart and their soul and their true experience, there's such a connection between students, and very often they go off and they create their own writing workshops after the class. And I always encourage people that if they ever get into a writing group that doesn't feel safe or is too it should be very honest, a writing group or a workshop or a class, but it should also be very, very safe and nurturing. And if a writing class doesn't feel that way, get out.
Mm-hmm.
Life is too short to go through that kind of stuff. So,
boy, I agree with that.
Yeah. And I think I do believe, and I encourage, you know, that you are very honest. But there are ways of being honest, and you can be very honest and also very encouraging at the same time. So that's a huge challenge in every writing class. But I'm always amazed at how really kind and curious other people are, even in Los Angeles in these classes, that people are incredibly respectful of each other in writing classes and encouraging.
Don't you think when people have this creative modality within them, when they give it the chance to breathe, that it allows them to interact with other creative people and endows them with a sense of permission to let this part of themselves give birth to a whole new dimension in their thinking and their expression? And what you said about being in the safe environment, it's all right. You're not worrying about grammar perfection. You're not worrying about, you are merely saying, let this out. Let the beauty of who you have within yourself come out and express in the written word. And you mentioned right at the beginning when we were chatting that you make your students work. You make them do exercises, and you call it mind-muscle gym. I guess that's how it would be described, gym exercise. Tell us about some of the other exercises that you do.
Well, I have different ones, different prompts and different exercises, but basically the bottom line is that they're always 5 minutes long, because 5 minutes doesn't give you any chance to write something brilliant, really. And yet it is amazing what can come up in 5 minutes. And if I told them to write, well, you can write about the fog this morning for 15 minutes. Well, then they'd sit there and they'd brood and they'd rewrite and they'd, you know, second guess themselves. But when I say you have 5 minutes to write about fog, they have to jump in. The only rule to the exercise is that their pen or pencil can't stop moving. So they can write anything. They can write their market list if they get frustrated, or they can just sit there and write, I'm so frustrated, I hate this exercise. But the point is they're writing, and they're getting out of their own way. And then they start, and eventually they start, something comes up out of their subconscious or, you know, whatever, wherever it comes from, and they can write astonishing things. I mean, I have students who have started novels with 5 minute exercises, and a lot of essays get started. In fact, my next book is going to be called Kicking in the Wall, which is 365 days of writing prompts and quotes, because I think quotes from other writers or from poems. I use a lot of poetry and you know, really wonderful writing in my class by other writers, which inspires them. And I start every class with a poem. And I say, you know, if you like it, great. If you don't like it, you never have to hear or read this poem again. And then I often take an idea or a line from the poem for a 5 minute exercise. And again, you know, if it doesn't work for them, so what? It's only 5 minutes. It's like doing sit-ups. It's not a big deal. But sometimes they hook into something and I say, ignore me for the rest of the class if you get on a roll with this and want to keep writing. You know, mm-hmm. This is not a math or a science class. It's to get you writing. And so I used basically a lot of prompts, and then sometimes I will do an exercise to show them the difference between fiction and nonfiction, and I'll have them take something out of their purse or pocket and say, write about this for 5 minutes. Where did you get it? How do you feel about it? And they all dutifully write about their watch or their wallet or whatever. And then I say, okay, hand it to the person next to you. And when you get a different object other than your own, this belongs to somebody called BJ. And where did BJ get it? And how does BJ feel about it? And then they write that, and I say, you know, there's no, you have to make this stuff up. Mm-hmm. And so it shows them the difference between nonfiction and fiction. And a lot of people just love making up the story more than writing the truth about their own object. So that's one of my favorite exercises that I actually made up myself about 15 years ago for my students.
Well, I think it's a wonderful exercise, and I think it allows an elasticity in thinking, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. to me is just very important. I found in your material that you had, and this was on day 14, mm-hmm. and you titled it Waiting for Pizza. You really encourage people to keep a diary.
Yes.
You say, distill your day's experience into a single sentence each day. Mm-hmm. Call it the mm-hmm. coat hanger journal. And also you recommend carrying a notebook with you. When I think about this, I'm reminded about someone that I heard who was very famous, Steve Allen. And this man was considered a genius in show business by many of his peers, both musically as well as writing mm-hmm. and performing and speaking and this type of thing. Very talented man, and he had a habit. He had notepads in every single room. Every single room. He had them all over the place. So that he could write down his ideas when they came to him, because the ideas were very much like a dandelion in its puffy stage. It just is so light and airy, you blow on it and it's going to go away.
Exactly.
And that's what he did, and he would save those notes. And he'd go through them, and all of a sudden something would start working in his head. And a journal, I think, is a very, very good thing for people to do. I've journaled, for goodness gracious, most of my life.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very good tool to use.
Oh, I think it's essential whether people want to write or not. I mean, just to keep, like that coat hanger idea was something that I had read in a magazine, and they, you know, just one sentence a day even will kind of help you keep track of your life. And I keep a journal where some days, if things are really going well and I'm very busy, I really don't have a whole lot to say, so I'll just write down the weather or just in very boring prose what I've done that day, or just a few lines even. And then if I'm ever, you know, in other days I will write pages and pages and pages. And if I'm upset about something, I always write it out in my journal. And I'm amazed that, yes, it really does help you heal, you know. I'm always telling my students that, and then I realize, of course, this really, really works. And also, life goes so fast and is such, you know, is so chaotic, and now we're all, you know, we're so busy with all our electronics and everything. To keep track of our life in language and is just an amazing thing, to go back a few years or five or decades later and read what you were thinking and doing. And it's such a, I think it's such a gift to yourself.
Well, I
and
think
any,
so too.
Yeah.
I agree. Now, one of the things that you say a writer needs, which I concur with, mm-hmm. is silence and solitude. Mm-hmm. And I myself love conference rooms at libraries. And the reason I like it is because I can go into a library, and depending on the time of the year, they may or may not be available, but if you find out a quiet time and you're able to go in there, or if you have a place that you can retreat to, I know a guy that would go to Starbucks, even as noisy as it was, he could just zone out, and he would just sit there with his cup of coffee for hours, and nobody bothered him, because at home
exactly.
he was constantly interrupted. Mm-hmm. And Walter Mosley said, turn the ringer off your phone, don't answer the doorbell, tell your loved ones you cannot be disturbed, and if they cannot bear to live without you, go right in a coffee shop or a library, rent a room if you have to, just make the time to write your book. Boy, I
yes.
can testify to that, Barbara. What is your yeah. special place? Where do you go so that the noise of everyday life isn't going to be distracting you?
Well, I actually have an office now in the house, and it's sort of apart from the hubbub of the house. And I go to my office, like, you know, it's an office, or I, you know, where people go to factories or wherever people go to work, and I try to think of it that way. But before I've had this office, you know, in the very beginning I had the kitchen table, and I had little babies 11 months apart. And so when I started writing seriously, as a grown-up, I would shut the kitchen door, and I'd set the oven timer for 1 hour, and I would tell my children, who are little babies, they could barely walk, and I would say, you know, it's nap time, and when you hear the ringer buzz, you may come in, and you can't open that door unless you're bleeding or something horrible has happened. And so they took me very seriously, and I could hear them whispering outside the door, you know, as I was writing. But I thought I would just go crazy if I didn't take that hour all for myself and be totally selfish. And it worked, and I really started writing very seriously. And then they were in kindergarten, and then I would write while they were at school. And that it actually gets harder when you're older and you have the kids are grown, and then you have to make your own very strict schedule. Because you're not making it because of other people. I mean, you say, okay, I'm because there's also the temptation of writing constantly then. So, it's much more fluid. I'm more fluid with my schedule now because I also have writing deadlines. So, my writing time is dependent on when I have a book due or an essay due or something. But yeah, I think everybody, and in the book I mentioned, you know, you figure out for yourself. There's no magic formula of how or when writers write. Some writers write all day. Some writers will write for 2 hours in the morning. Or I think William Stafford would get up at 5 and write until the sun came up. So everybody has to come up with their own schedule. I had a student who the only time in her life that she had to write was at lunchtime, and she would leave her job and go to a restaurant and write for an hour and then go back to her job and then her family at the end of the day. So it's it's possible. You just have to figure it out and be selfish, too.
I concur. Now, there is a quote here by Graham Greene in your book that I really liked, and this is day number 52. It's the writer as spy. And this is what he said. The great advantage of being a writer is that you can spy on people. You're there listening to every word, but part of you is observing. Everything is useful to a writer. You see every scrap, even the longest and most boring of luncheon parties. And, yes. You know, I read that quote, and I can just imagine someone listening to it say, you have got to be kidding. But a good writer is someone that not only comes across with feeling with the use of their words, but also with the observations that they make. And it's a fascinating thing, and I love that. You could be sitting in your favorite coffee shop or at McDonald's or someplace else, and you're watching people. It's a fascinating environment.
It is fascinating, and I think, though, that there are days when a writer, I mean, there are many days when I don't find things, I can sit and look at people, and I don't find it interesting unless I write it down. If I write down what people are doing, here's another exercise, and it's really Twyla Tharp's exercise in her book on creativity, but you go out in public, and you find a couple, and you write down every single thing that that couple does. You know, if they hold hands, or if they look at their cell phone, or if they touch each other's cheek, whatever is going on, you write it down until you have about 15 or 20 things they did. Then that's the first part of the exercise. Then you find another couple, and you only write down what you find they do that's interesting. And what very often happens is that you feel great anxiety and you don't find that much interesting. However, if you go back to that first exercise, you will have a whole lot of material about what two people do together. And I think there's something that there are days when we just zone out and we just don't feel like we're very sharp, or I feel this way anyway. I don't feel very sharp or observant or... And if I sit down, though, and I do this a lot on vacations, and if I write down what people are saying and what people are doing, later I find it so interesting. But if I judge before I write it down, I might not write it down. Does that make sense? Yeah.
I really loved what you learned from babysitting a child, Emma, for a week when she was 6 years old, and this is on day 59. You said creativity, energy, emotion, and passion, focus, and curiosity. Interestingly enough, I was writing about that this morning because my newsletter is going to be going out today. And I was writing about that very fact, how when we're children, we have all of this curiosity. We have all of these unique perceptions. We're open. We're receptive. We're exploring. You watch a little person and their little bare feet are just anxious to touch rocks, everything else, even though they might fall down and bump and scrape their knees and cry. They are there. This is like, I don't have time. I can't wait. I got to find out as much as I possibly can.
Exactly.
And then we go through the growing up, the adolescence, and the adolescence is total confusion many times. We're trying to figure out who we are, what do we want to do, the hormones are kicking in, we have all this. Then we get into adulthood and we're supposed to have all the answers. We find out we're lucky if we know even one.
Right.
And then there's a process after that, and then hopefully there reaches a point, maybe in midlife, you go, you know what, I think I better think about things. And when you go through these processes, you have to almost go back to that childlike part of yourself for the very things, creativity, energy, emotion, passion, focus, and curiosity. All of these things are marvelous.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
They're marvelous. Barbara, you have so much phenomenal material in this book, and it's just a delight to go through it. It's inspirational, but more than anything else, I think inspiring people to write. You don't have to worry about writing for anybody else. Just write for yourself. Your book, A Year of Writing Dangerously, 365 Days of Inspiration and Encouragement, should be a must in a library. Now, I want to give out your websites. You have two. One is writingtime.typepad.com, writingtime.typepad.com, Or you can just type in Barbara Abercrombie, and Abercrombie is spelled A-B-E-R-C-R-O-M, like Mary, B-I-E. Barbara, you're a delight. Your material is wonderful, and you'll have to send me your next book.
I sure will, Donna. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Barbara Abercrombie has been my guest. If you know anyone that is an inspiring writer, this is a book they should have in their library, because they can go and refer to it at random, and it's just wonderfully refreshing. But it's so positive. It has so many wonderful quotes in it. Anybody would benefit from reading it. This is Donna Seaball. We're taking a break. We're going to come back in just a moment, and we'll be bringing our second guest in as well. This is Donna. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Seaball to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. And I want you to know my second guest today also is a writer, as all of the people who appear on my show are. His book is called Human Natures of Animal and Spiritual. Carol Blair is my guest. Welcome to the show, Carol.
Thank you. Pleased to be here, Donna.
Your book is a fascinating one. For you, it's a philosophical expression about human evolution, and you've written a number of short poems, expressions, and you've been an avid writer. I mean, you've got a number of publications that you have put out. I'm going to ask you a question. What is it that created the passion in writer for you? Why is it that you will take the time to write out these thoughts? Why is this so important to you?
Well, I don't know. I think that life should be one of contribution, one of purpose, and I think one should find what one is best at. And also, there seems to be other factors going on that move one in a certain direction. You have to be sensitive to the signals or, you know, to what's going on as far as what you should be doing. So you start on a path and you say, okay, this is good, but there's something, you just get a feeling that, no, I think I should be doing something else. So, you know, I started writing basically, I was studying music at the conservatory, and I did well there. You know, I graduated top of the class and all, but I just started to write thoughts and some poetry and some notebooks. I wasn't really thinking about, you know, being a writer at that time, but it just led me in that direction. So that's what... That plus what I said about wanting to make some kind of a contribution, making your life purposeful. So I thought that, well, you know, if I can get some ideas out there and if it can help some people put a little light in the world, that hopefully I can be of help.
In your book, you have a comment. You say, to all who go the journey to light in a world still deep in the dark. I think that when you reflect on history, if you read writings of people, no matter what time in history they are living through, there are always those dark times. Sometimes they are darker than others. but they're there. And you make a statement in your prologue saying the human world is still very much an animal world, and human evolution and spiritual evolution are one. And that to you is a very meaningful phrase. And in your many years of writing, you've expressed many, many different feelings. But I think that those that one grouping of words, human evolution and spiritual evolution, are one. There is that factor, that connection, that makes a conscious difference when that's there. What was the kernel of awareness for you that brought those words in the forefront of your mind?
Well, when I was growing up, you get signals about, you know, how, you know, the human world is basically good and wise and noble, and, you know, there's some exceptions here and there, but, you know, you hear things, I think, that are a bit inflated. So I was wondering, the theory didn't match with the practice as far as my experiences in life. So I says, you know, by and large, I mean, of course, there have been some people who've transcended the egocentric life, which basically what I call like the animal life, like the lower nature, the impetus moved out through selfishness, but not really enough to think of ourselves as lofty as a lot of people would like to think, especially nowadays with the New Age movements, that we're divine beings, we're spiritual beings. Well, I think we're that in potential. I think if we do the inner work as individuals, we can aspire to that, but I don't think we should be thinking that that is a given. So I thought that, yeah, when I see what's going on with, you know, you look at history and you see that the corruptions and power plays and all the greed and all the, you know, really base behaviors, this isn't new what's going on today. So you see the same things going on now. That's been going on since the first, like the dawn of recorded history. So, and the reason why that is because I think people don't focus where the real problem is, either because they're not aware of it or they're too afraid to look at it. But the problem is not out there, it's inside us. What we see outside in the world is a reflection in the collective of what's inside us. It's a mirror. So if you really want to get serious about fixing any problem that's sustainable and not just moving things around outside that gives the illusion of some substantive change, then the place to look is inside ourselves. That's where we need to go. But of course, that takes courage, and it's painful to take a look, you know, especially for the first time, and say, you know, well, I guess I'm not as smart as I thought I was. I guess I'm not as noble as I thought I was. And so, you know, but you really have to do that, and I think it starts with humility. So, yeah, human nature, so I still see in its operations, the world is still to me very much an animal world, the human world, and the way it operates, and the way that many times, I think actually the majority of times that people deal with each other, they're not thinking about what's fair and what's right and what's good, you know, putting self-interest aside for the greater good. They're thinking about, well, you know, what's in it for me? What can I get out of this and that? And that to me is really on the animal level. So that's why I say the human world is still very much an animal world.
Well, we are animals. When you get
true
down to the real, that we are. That's what we are.
Yeah, well, we are animals, but we're mm-hmm. the only species on the planet, and maybe in the universe. Of course, we have no knowledge of that, but that would be even more awesome. But we're the only species on the planet that have the capacity to transcend that. Mm-hmm. See, all other animals in nature, they do what they do because it's the governing force of nature. They have no other choice but to do that. You take lions go out and they make a kill. Why? Not because they want to be murderers, but because they have to eat, and that's the way that nature has designed it, the checks and balances. Human beings, however, we're capable of transcending that. We're capable of going beyond that. And I think if we're capable of doing that, then we have an obligation to do that. We have a duty to do that. We have a duty to live at the highest plane that we are capable of. And we see evidence of that. We see evidence, of course, with the great spiritual leaders that have come into the world. We see that when, you look at the Sistine Chapel, you look at Michelangelo's work, you hear Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, you see that we're able to do that. I mean, to be more than just animal on animal.
You have a number of different comments throughout your book. And again, these are little paragraphs for someone to take a bite, a mental bite of, where they can read it, think about it. And I think your book is a stimulation.
Perception. It is a unifying work, though. May I say this as a comment? Yes, it's true that you can take a comment here and there, but it is meant to be read from beginning to end. All of those thoughts are unified, one connecting to the next. So,
Okay. And you have a comment in here of grand structure of the pyramids built a stone at a time. And so it is with the building of spiritual character. One step at a time, one trial at a time. And then there was a comment you made, the deeds of a human being are the ornaments of his or her ideal. And I thought, that is really very complementary to what I remember being taught as a child, watch a person and what they do, not just what they say. What do they do? Are their deeds, are their actions corresponding with what they're mouthing? And if you apply that to every application in life, whether it's a corporation, whether it's your next-door neighbor, yourself, anything, that is a good way to measure. Because if the deeds don't follow the words, so many people are upset with the political environment for that very reason. The words are out there flowing. The actions are not supporting the words that are flowing. And so consequently, there's the lie perceived, there's the deception perceived, there's the dishonesty perceived. All of these things, it takes being mindfully present, not assuming, but mindfully present. And you go through so many different aspects. And one of the thoughts you also had was, to allow an untamed animal to roam freely in one's house would be tantamount to allowing the animal to take it over. And it's the same with the inner house.
Absolutely. That's what I mean. We have to do that inner work. We have to subdue those impulses that, you know, like the inclination to want to just live in a way that we're not really all that concerned with what's going on with other people or with how our actions, you know, impact others. We have to broaden our consciousness. We have to be more considerate. We have to be more thoughtful of what we're doing, especially now when you think of with the technology that we have. We have thousands of hydrogen bombs. We have means to decimate the environment at an alarming rate. We have over 7 billion people on the planet. We need it's a matter of survival now, as I see it. See, up until about maybe about 150 years ago or so, you could have, there was a choice where people, and when you look at history, you see that there's some have always, you know, gone that journey, but it's always a small percentage. They say, no, I want something better than this. I don't want to just think about, you know, like live a life of just selfishness, basically. I want something more than this. This doesn't feel right. I want something better. And they work on themselves, and they manage to transcend that. But now we're at a point where it's no longer a choice if we're going to survive, because early on, if you look at the very beginnings of our existence, our most ancient ancestors, they needed to live a life that was basically self-centered, because it was a matter of life or death. Like, they lived like in a climate that was very harsh and brutal, and it was a matter of survival. But ironically, what's going on now is the very thing that allowed our ancient ancestors to succeed, and so we could evolve to other stages. We're at a point now where we have to lose that. We have to go another way. We have to really go in the opposite direction. We have to leave that selfish impulse behind. Otherwise, I don't see how we can survive. We have we have global warming going on. There's some people that are still arguing about, well, does it exist or doesn't exist? Well, that's another subject. We don't probably have much time to get into that. All I'll say about that is I have two comments. One is it's irrelevant if it's if it's man-made or not. What we're doing to the environment is very disrespectful, and it's arrogant to assume that we can do that, just destroy habitats, pollute the water, the air, and the land, just because we want short-term, short-term interest, self-interest. But also, I think that we cannot survive as a species. I don't see, maybe other people have some other ideas, maybe you can enlighten me on that or some others, but I don't see how we can survive if we continue on this track of just consumption, 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 consume, 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 turning the planet basically like into a garbage dump of all these things that we consume. We're truly the most wasteful species. I mean,
Carol Blair, you have just such a passion for life. You have a passion for being able to be supportive of change. And I really think that we'll close out with one of the statements in your book. In the midst of worldly insanities, one must find one's way to sanity. In the midst of worldly follies, one must find one's way to wisdom. In the midst of worldly falsehoods, one must find one's way to truth. In the midst of worldly hatred, one must find one's way to love through guidance of a higher nature. I know we're just about out of time. You do have a website that people can go to find out more about this book, The Human Natures of Animal and Spiritual. It's a very reflective piece of publication, avionpublishing.com. That's A-V-E-O-N. Publishing.com is the website that you will be going to find out more about the intriguing writings of Carol Blair. Carol, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today. It was a delight.
Yes, thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking with you, Donna.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're coming back in just a moment. More good things to share. Don't go away.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are now open, 888-627-6008. Well, I'll tell you what, we've got a dynamic listing of guests for the rest of this week. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Shahzad Shamin about positive intelligence. And this is very insightful because Shahzad is a man who has done such a tremendous amount of work working with people, showing how you can create more really of what you want in your interactions with people. And it's a type of thinking that I think is marvelous and you really enjoy. And then we are doing Italian on Friday. Woohoo! I love Italian food. Of course, I'm Italian, part Italian anyway. And I just absolutely love the way the Italians have a passion for food. And it's good food. It's not just spaghetti and meatballs. The Italians, I remember being told when I was a child, taught the French how to cook. Aha! So this is something, they have a joy about food and preparation and social interaction
That's just a given. It's part of the culture. And we are going to be talking with one of the top chefs from New York. His name is Marcello Russo De Vito. And we're going to be talking food. He's got a wonderful story to share. He's been a chef for over 25 years, and he's just a marvelous man, and this book is incredibly good. So be sure you have your pad of paper and pen handy, because we're talking food on Friday. I mean, good grief. If you're like me, you were in an environment where you were always supposed to have this, have that, and your food and everything was just so dry and so tasteless. I mean, especially if you were on a diet. Oh, please. Do you know, and I'll share this with you quickly, a friend of ours, a family friend, went to Italy. She's Italian. And Janet loved to cook, absolutely loved to cook. And she was plump because she enjoyed the food. She was a wonderful cook. She goes to Italy. She dropped 2 dress sizes on her trip to Italy. She said, I ate whatever was there. She said, I ate like I do at home, but I dropped 2 dress sizes. You know what the difference was? In Italy, they walked everywhere. They walked to get their groceries. They walked to do this, that, or the other. And the village environment that she found herself in, because she went to visit some relatives, she said, we had to go every single day. Well, they didn't have cars to drive. They walked. She was surprised. By the time she came back from a trip where most people would be complaining about how fat they had gotten because of all the good food they ate, she didn't gain any weight. She said, and I weighed myself. The weight was the same, but I dropped 2 dress sizes because of the activity I was doing. She said, the movement and everything else. I'm telling you, lots of times we don't realize all we have to do is up the ante on ourselves physically. And the body will respond, and being active is important. It's very, very important. Well, I wanted to share some thoughts with you. I know we've got a little bit of time, and again, if you want to give me a quick buzz, 888-627-6008 is the number to call into. I don't know about you, but one of the more difficult lessons that I had to learn in life was not to take everything personally. And I can remember being raised that everybody else was right, and I was not right, and I really wasn't supposed to express any opinion. Does any of that resonate with any of you and your upbringing? Well, it was a part of mine. And we've all heard the quote from Lincoln about you can't please people all the time. But when you are doing things, when you're going about daily life, you're going to get 10,001 opinions from different people. Everybody has a view of life through their own perception, limited or unlimited. They're all going to have opinions. You do, so they will too. So you can feel like you just are really going to be in a pile of misery because maybe you get a bunch of criticisms about things. So a good attitude to have is, well, let me listen to that. What is it? Is there some validity to what they're saying? If you examine it and you don't find that there is, then okay. Then you say, well, that's not true in my case. You know, sometimes criticisms are very valuable. They help you become aware of certain things. I think of a young man that I knew that didn't realize that whenever he went for an interview, he just reeked. He was from another country. He didn't bathe. It wasn't their custom to bathe, and he didn't use a deodorant. So he was stinky. Finally, someone said, you need to take a bath, and you need to use a deodorant. It hadn't even crossed his mind that that was something that he needed to do. Now, listening to it, you may say, oh, that's so silly. No, it isn't. A lot of people, their worlds are not exposed to areas of understanding. So when you're criticized, or when someone is criticizing you, and you may ask them, what suggestion do you have for me? Don't sit there and be a victim. Ask, what can be done about this? Is it valid? There is a quote. It says, there's only one method of meeting life's test. Just keep on a striving and hope for the best. Don't give up the ship and quit in dismay, because hammers are thrown when you'd like a bouquet. This world will be tiresome, we'd all get the blues, if all the folks in it just held the same view. So finish your work, show the best of your skill. Some folks won't like it, some folks will. This is done by an unknown author. I think it's so important for us to realize that as individuals, we each have our own particular expression. Don't be afraid of criticism. Don't look at it as an enemy, which I did for so many years. You need to be aware that who you are does make a difference. And you're always going to find room for improvement. I don't care if you live to be 120. There's always something you can learn from someone else that you can do better for yourself in your own life. But it's good to question. It's good to be curious. It's good to find out. This is part of what life is all about. Discovering ourselves, finding out our strengths, our weaknesses, and realizing we do the very best that we can with what we have. And who knows? We may surpass everybody else that was criticizing us the whole time. This is Donna Siebel. I hope you have an utterly magnificent day wherever you are, or evening wherever you might be. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is your life. Live it with joy, expectation of the best. Because you might be surprised. You'll get more of the best than not when you have that kind of attitude. This is Donna Siebel. Have a great day. We'll talk with you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.